everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week at this time, we assemble a panel to discuss important issues that are not given the attention or objective insights that they deserve. Today, we are talking about the recent rise in pro-vaccination efforts to mandate vaccines, remove vaccine exemptions, and hold parents of unvaccinated children legally liable for lawsuits. Our panel, from Evanston, Illinois, Dr. Toni Bark. She is a pediatric physician and a prestigious homeopathic and holistic practitioner in the Chicago area. This year, she was awarded the honor of Vice President of the American Institute of Homeopathy. She has medical degrees from Rush Medical College and a pediatric internship at New York University. She also holds degrees, including master's in healthcare, from Boston University Medical School. She is a regular speaker at the University of Chicago, and her website is disease-reversal.com. She is joined by Professor Mary Holland. Dr. Holland is a director of the Graduate Legal Skills Program at New York University School of Law, specializing in international human rights, public law and vaccine safety law, and injury compensation. She has degrees from Harvard University, and she received her Doctor of Jurisprudence from Columbia University. She has also taught international law at its law school. She is the author, or co-author, I should say, of Vaccine Epidemic, How Corporate Greed, Biased Science, and Coercive Government Threaten Our Human Rights, Our Health, and Our Children. The book is Vaccine Epidemic, and the website is vaccineepidemic.com. She is joined by Alan Phillips, also a doctor of jurisprudence, practicing in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He is one of the few American attorneys whose legal practice focuses on vaccine exemptions and vaccine waivers. He is an advisory board member of the American Chiropractic Autism Board, the World Association for Vaccine Education, and is a co-founder of the North Carolina Citizens for Healthcare Freedom. He is also the author of Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, as well as Dispelling Vaccination Myths, an introduction to the contradictions between medical science and immunization policy, which has been translated around the world. His website is vaccinerights.com. And our final panelist today, from New York City, is Robert Krakow. He is a New York City trial lawyer in private practice and one of the nation's leading attorneys for vaccine-damaged children through the government's Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. He has handled almost every kind of civil and criminal case in all federal and state courts. He's been a trial lawyer for over 30 years and is a former Narcotics Bureau chief in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. He also founded several not-for-profit organizations advocating for the rights of individuals with special needs and is a renowned critic of the dominant medical belief that present vaccines are safe and effective. He's a graduate of the George Washington University Law School and served in the past as the director of the Consumer Protection Center. The website is krakowlawfirm.com. Nice to have you all with us today.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, Gary.
For those who are joining us for the first time, and I'm pleased to say that we have about 1,800,000 new listeners in the last year using our website with downloading articles, about 13,800,000 page reads in the last 12 months, and we're the number one Google search engine progressive radio station in the world. And this is the program most often listened to, because it's a serious program. But also, I don't do a lot of talking. For those of you who are new on board, this is more like a classroom on the air. Each person will have an opportunity to speak with follow-up questions and to give the breadth and depth of what they believe on a particular issue, one person at a time. I'm going to begin with you on this one, Toni.
Okay.
Perhaps the primary argument we find in all of the pro-vaccination attempts to mandate vaccines and remove vaccine exemptions and now present the case to hold parents of unvaccinated children legally liable for any infectious vaccination children come down with in schools is their reliance on the idea of herd immunity. However, if the theory of herd immunity is found faulty or fallacious, then their entire house of cards begins to collapse. And for the moment, putting aside the fact that no vaccine is 100% effective or safe, please explain the pro-vax nation's community view of herd immunity to support their proposals, and then speak about the medical errors in their hypothesis.
Great. So the term herd immunity actually comes from populations where diseases are endemic, and typically where children are exposed at a very early age, let's say to polio or cholera, and do not express disease symptomatology, are healthy as adults. But when we test these populations, especially right now, like native populations in Brazil and the Amazon, in certain areas of Southeast Asia, we'll test populations where there's no evidence of disease, but they all test positive for antibodies to all three types of polio or to cholera. So that is the concept of herd immunity, is where there's disease exposure and lack of real symptomatology typically, or in some cases, like, you know, where childhood diseases were popular before we started vaccinating them away, children would go through a phase, and specifically at certain ages, develop measles, chickenpox, and they would get through it and they would be stronger for it. And then as adults, their immunity was actually strong. And so that was considered herd immunity. The concept of herd immunity is real in populations where people actually get the true disease and develop their own immune response and then pass it on in, either through transplacental passage of antibodies and immunity in utero for women in terms of their offspring, and then again through breastfeeding. But this does not apply whatsoever to vaccination. In fact, I've got in front of me a very partial list, by the way, of outbreaks, known studied outbreaks, specifically of measles, pertussis, and mumps, since the 90s until now, throughout the Western world. I'm not even going to talk about the undeveloped areas of the world, but through the Western world where we vaccinated. And in most cases, the outbreaks of measles, mumps, and pertussis are in fully vaccinated populations. And in some of these cases, the few unvaccinated are not even touched by the disease. So we've had private schools around this country and in England where it was a fully vaccinated 85, 90, 95% of the population was vaccinated against measles, and yet 500, 600 kids come down with measles, and the few kids who were not vaccinated don't even get the measles. And what, of course, the pro-vaccine public health officials like to say is that the unvaccinated were benefiting from the herd immunity of the vaccinated, which makes no sense because the vaccinated are the ones getting the disease. So it's a very interesting concept that's thrown around, and really thrown around inappropriately, because it just does not apply to vaccination. It applies to the true disease with a true immune response, with true transplacental and maternal antibodies coming through the milk. And that's really what herd immunity applies to.
One follow-up for you. Having studied the world literature on the safety and efficacy of vaccines, can you say with any certainty, based upon the science, not personal opinion or bias, are all the vaccines individually and collectively proven safe and effective for any given individual?
Well, no, we can't say that. I mean, that's just not even looked at. In fact, just about every Cochrane and large-scale study, and the Cochrane, for people who don't know what that is an international collaboration on looking at medical practices and vaccinations. And on every large-scale study that they've done, they end with safety studies that don't exist and they're needed. So whether they find the vaccine effective or not, the safety is unknown. And, of course, you cannot make a statement regarding a risk-benefit ratio if you don't know what your risks are. And that is part of the equation, and it's a huge part of the equation. So we have that, and then we also have articles talking, like the one that I pulled up today from the Journal of Infectious Disease, Journal of Royal Medicine, Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, which is that vaccinated populations actually increase outbreaks in younger and older people. And so in measles, specifically with the MMR, we've got maternal antibodies that are just waning because women that are having children now never had measles or mumps or rubella, and so they only had the vaccine, and they have no the antibodies that are inferred to the fetus and to the newborn are just not there, and they're not adequate. And so we're seeing outbreaks in the population, in the vaccinated population. And in the case of the chickenpox vaccine, what we see is that it did push chickenpox out of the picture for the most part, but what we see is shingles occurring in a much younger age group than we used to see, let's say, before we started mass vaccinating against chickenpox. And so we know that it's a very complex picture. The risk-benefit ratios have never been looked at because the safety studies just are not done, and if they are ignored. And so we cannot say at all that vaccines are safe and effective, because the effectiveness is another thing that is not looked at for the most part. For the most part, efficacy or an immunogenicity, which is just an antibody response, is looked at. And antibodies do not necessarily infer immunity. They are part of the picture, but they're the safety net, whereas innate immunity is actually 90% of our immune response, and vaccinations do not touch innate immunity. And therefore, they don't have to prove effectiveness when they go to the FDA for approval. They just have to show that they infer an antibody response to a certain percentage of the population in the studies. And lastly, when we have vaccine studies, don't include people with autoimmune diseases. We don't include pregnant women. We don't include people on chemo. And cancer patients are not the only patients who take chemo. People with autoimmune diseases and other diseases take forms of chemo, HIV patients. So these are patients that are left out of the equation in studies, and yet they are patients that are then in the group when it's recommended to give vaccination, specifically now with pregnant women. And so, no, to answer your question, we cannot say that vaccines are safe and effective.
We'll come back to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Holland, a bioethicist who is a professor at New York University, Dr. Art Kaplan, recently wrote on his Harvard Law Review blog and later in a subsequent interview on NPR's Now and There program that parents of unvaccinated children should be held legally liable if someone catches a virus like measles or pertussis and has a serious health problem from it. Review for us, please, Dr. Kaplan's argument, and then I'd like you to rebut it if you see fit, and also address the fact that Kaplan is using the recent measles outbreak in the UK and Brooklyn as supporting examples for his argument to charge unvaccinated people as the cause of these outbreaks. However, in the recent cases in Wales in the United Kingdom, we did a great deal of research and found virtually no evidence except for one case where proper diagnostic tests were performed to support that there was even any measles outbreak except in one person. Therefore, they overstated it, they were inaccurate, and that is now a matter of record. Would you address these, please?
Thank you. Yes, Dr. Kaplan recently wrote an article suggesting that parents do have the right to exercise a religious exemption on behalf of their children and not attend school or attend with an exemption. But in his view, as in several other people's views in recent years that have written articles on this, they believe that people who are spreading disease should bear the consequences of that choice. So in their world, if a child transmits measles to another child who presumably has been vaccinated, but it's not a totally effective vaccine, as Dr. Kaplan acknowledges, then the parents of the child who fell ill because of the unvaccinated child who transmitted the disease, the family that transmitted the disease should be economically liable for that choice. So several legal scholars and doctors have made this case over the last several years, and I find it very interesting and troubling as a legal argument. First, let me just take a step back. If you think about what vaccination is. It's a very serious medical intervention. All vaccines, like all prescription medicines, are considered to be unavoidably unsafe under the law. So this is a very serious medical intervention. And since World War II, the whole world has embraced the concept that there must be informed consent, that compulsory medicine is simply unacceptable to us in the modern world. So in essence, Dr. Kaplan is arguing for something exceedingly close to compulsory medicine. But on the issue of liability, there's just lots of legal problems with it. As he acknowledges, no vaccines are 100% effective. So he is acknowledging by stating that somebody who has been vaccinated could transmit disease. How will we know, as between an unvaccinated child and a child who was defectively vaccinated, whose vaccine didn't protect them, which one was the transmitting person to a third child in the classroom? He says that the tracing is very, very good. Well, tracing isn't really that good to the best of our knowledge today. We won't be able to tell. This group of people making this argument wants to see people who make a choice not to vaccinate as scapegoats for outbreaks of disease. Infectious disease is not a good thing. Nobody wants to have infectious disease, but that doesn't mean that people who make the choice not to vaccinate are always responsible for outbreaks. And as you pointed out, an outbreak of one person was all you were able to uncover. What we find time and again is that the claims that the unvaccinated are wildly transmitting disease and putting everyone else at risk, those are wildly exaggerated claims.
A follow-up for you, please. As Dr. Tony mentioned a few moments ago, there are no studies, and my staff and I have examined it extensively, that every study in the world on vaccines for safety and efficacy, and we find it's all over the board as far as their statement of efficacy versus what they've been able to prove. For example, if you take 100 people and you vaccinate them, and at the end of a year, they all got the flu vaccine, and at the end of the year, if 50 of them didn't get the flu, you can't then automatically say it was the vaccine that protected them. No different than I could say that giving 100 people 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day and they didn't get a cold, it was the vitamin C that prevented the cold.
Right.
And yet, everyone is lined up, no matter what their body size or age or medical circumstances, to receive the same identical vaccine. I'd like to know how the U.S. Department of Public or the U.S. Public Health Service and the FDA and the CDC and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, all of these organizations, oversee different aspects of vaccines, how they can say with such certainty that all vaccines are safe and effective, no matter how many a person receives or what the background of the vaccine is. Could you address this, please?
Well, Gary, I think that you've addressed a very important paradox. On the one hand, people like Dr. Kaplan, who are speaking from an industry standpoint, or certainly a standpoint that's consonant with industry's input viewpoint, they say that vaccines are safe and effective. And yet, as a legal matter, we all know that vaccines can cause injury. Bob Krakow will speak to the fact that we have a federal compensation program because we acknowledge that vaccines always carry the risk of injury or death. They are by law considered unavoidably unsafe. So products can't be both safe and effective and unavoidably unsafe at the same time, in my book.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Bob Krakow, to you now, please. It would appear that the attempt to pass policies that would make parents of unvaccinated children legally liable for infectious damages to other children, from my personal and subjective point of view, is without merit, since already we find the law not fully compensating vaccine injuries. I've interviewed over 1,000 parents who to this day have not received a penny of compensation, even though their children suffer from a range of injuries, including full-spectrum autistic disorders, and they have their medical documentation, and yet they have not received compensation. So to me, it's not a level playing field, and I believe they can't have it both ways. As I understand it, the funds for paying out injuries comes from the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, derives from a very small tax placed on every vaccine sold. So what do you see are the main loopholes and failures in the current vaccine laws and compensation program that need to be addressed before we can honestly have a serious debate about vaccine mandates or holding parents accountable for spreading an infectious disease.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to be on the program. And in answer to that question, following up something Mary alluded to, the very foundation of the vaccine injury compensation program in the law was an acknowledgement by Congress and everyone who participated in the enactment of that law in 1986 was that vaccine injury occurs. There's no controversy about that, notwithstanding apologists for the vaccine industry and people like Arthur Kaplan and others claiming that vaccines are completely safe or largely safe. We know that they're not completely safe. The only debatable question is how often vaccine injury occurs. And from what we've seen, we can't determine that because the studies have not been done, as Dr. Bark alluded to. We don't know how often it occurs, but we know anecdotally parents say it occurs. So what we've seen now is a pattern and extends from the vaccine injury program to the law affecting mandates to the enforcement of mandates to what amounts to a form of legal bullying of parents and harassment of parents who dare to assert the fact that their child may be vaccine injured because they observe the child regress shortly after vaccination. When that assertion is made, the legal world, the world of authorities, the education world comes down on these parents, denying the fact that that could have occurred. So the parents are now branded as liars. Their word is not credited. Their word is dismissed. And the amount of corroborating information that's required to prove a vaccine injury has been elevated to the point where no one can meet that standard. There are a host of problems in the enforcement of the vaccine program and administration of the vaccine injury program. But in my opinion, it starts with that. It starts with a premise that vaccines are safe, and if we acknowledge a vaccine injury, the foundations of the Western world are going to crumble. And I think that starts to begin to explain the problems with the vaccine program, which we could enumerate all the problems that exist from the shortest statute of limitations known to law, from the suppression of experts who want to come forward and testify by eliminating funding for experts, by harassing experts, by discrediting experts unfairly, by lack of funding for experts in the program, which is a serious problem. And we could spend a whole program of several hours talking about the shortcomings of the vaccine program. That said, I'm not saying that the program, the legal framework that that program replaced is any better, because to sue the pharmaceutical industry, a lone parent would have to muster huge resources. And that's why we had the vaccine program in the first place. So what we have is a situation which large corporations make a lot of money now on vaccines. They have blockbuster vaccines, Prevnar being the first one. Gardasil was hoped to be another one. I don't know if it reached its potential. And there are others in the pipeline. There are hundreds of vaccines in the pipeline. Using their economic power, their influence in Congress, to pretend that vaccine injury doesn't exist, and to, in fact, make it very difficult to the point of legal bullying, as I said before, make it very difficult to bring any kind of claim within court without court. It comes to the point where if you dare to say there's a vaccine injury, you dare to claim an exemption, now we have this resurgence of this idea that you're endangering the public. Or, in fact, the opposite may be happening, or, in fact, the vaccines themselves may be endangering the public. And this is really where the controversy lies.
Two subsequent issues to follow up with you. The first is we had Dr. Kessler, David Kessler, the former commissioner of the FDA, who's both a medical doctor and an attorney, on this program. And when I asked him about how frequent is it that we do not get the adverse effects reported, the statistics are really shocking. As little as 1% to as many as 10% of adverse effects are actually reported, which means that instead of having, let's say, 330,000 cases, it could be 3 million cases. So we're not even begin to look at how serious this is. That said, the second point is, this is an article from Malcolm Holland, the Daily Telegraph. Quote, monitoring system to globally track false social media claims on dangerous vaccines. British and American scientists have developed a computerized monitoring system which alerts experts to quickly spread rumors, outright lies, misinformation, and legitimate public concerns about vaccines in 144 countries. Quote, recent measles outbreak in the UK stemming from children not vaccinated due to fears prompted by now discredited researcher over a decade ago is one example of the long-term consequences of broken public trust in vaccines, lead author Heidi Larson from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine said, quote, the internet has speeded up the global spread of unchecked rumors and misinformation about vaccines and can seriously undermine public confidence, leading to low rates of vaccination uptake and even disease outbreak. Now, it goes on to talk about now, in effect, they're going to make sure that anyone who makes any statement will be challenged, no matter how accurate. First of all, I would challenge immediately the person who wrote this, because Dr. Larson should have known that that the recent, quote, measles outbreaks in UK and Wales, there was one case, and the discredited person, wrong. It was a team, and the team had many members, and they never actually made a statement. If anyone read the actual letter in the Lancet or the article in the Lancet, they were merely reporting on specific types of bowel disorders in children diagnosed with autism and wanted to see, was there an association between a specific MMR vaccine and that condition, which they found. They never said that the MMR vaccine or vaccination caused autism. To the contrary, every single one of the doctors, all who were experts in their field, including what is arguably considered the world's leading expert on gastroenterology, are all pro-vaccine people. Now, here's the interesting part. The lead doctor who lost his medical license and was hammered, shamefully so in the American media, especially by people of the ilk of CNN's Anderson Cooper and Dr. Gupta, he just won. He had all of his reputation completely cleared in what amounts to the Supreme Court of Great Britain. The other person who did not have the $600,000 to appeal and go through the system was charged for the same actual conditions. He would have been cleared, Dr. Andrew Wakefield. So we have people now saying, we're going to check you. We're not going to allow you to get out there on the internet, make any statements. We're going to monitor you. To me, this is a brilliant move, because it then means that they will have more impact on those people like yourselves on the internet than what they would have had if you were just without them. But that's also medical McCarthyism. Your follow-up thoughts, please.
Well, my follow-up thoughts is there's more misinformation about this subject from the side that wants to impose mandatory vaccination from the other side, starting with the misleading information about the measles, supposed measles epidemic in Wales. Every time there's a pertussis outbreak in the United States, and there are many times in our area in New York that that's occurred, the claim is that, as Dr. Bark said, that the unvaccinated children infected the other children who had to be also unvaccinated. In fact, pertussis occurs in the vaccinated children, and there's no link to a vector in unvaccinated children. So you're seeing promulgation of false information by the side that wants to impose what you're calling medical McCarthyism, and I would agree with that. It's an authoritarian effort. And now there's the effort through electronic medical records and other information gathering to elevate the legal bullying of parents that you see in many forms, including interrogations of parents who want exemptions. I'm sure Alan Phillips can talk about that. And you're seeing that elevated to a global level using the internet. It's truly a frightening prospect, what's happening here. And that happens in the context where vaccination rates in the United States are at an all-time high. There is no time that we've had more children vaccinated than now. So I don't understand the reaction, except it's an effort to have 100% compliance in the belief that somehow unvaccinated people are causing a problem. It's just not happening. So that's my reaction to that.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate your insights. Alan Phillips, would you please speak about the recent attempts being made to increase vaccination rates in the United States now? For example, Obamacare would permit door-to-door vaccination, and doctors' health insurance programs reward them for vaccinating, and there are others. So if you were asked to give the main policies and proposals underway during the past 5 or so years to prove that the U.S. is becoming more rigid and authoritarian, as Bob just said, and almost a medical state regarding vaccination of its population, what would be your overview?
First of all, it's a real honor to be here with such a distinguished panel and to be given the privilege and opportunity to contribute. Gary, I've seen a very disturbing trend in recent years, a really aggressive increase on multiple levels to impose more vaccines, not only just on the children who are already getting them, but on completely new categories of people, and just at multiple levels. I try to go out of my way to avoid being sensationalistic, to be neutral, to check my facts and so forth, but even I have found myself using the phrase vaccine police state as a phrase to capture what looks to me like the direction we're moving in. There are, as we speak, something on the order of about 100 bills pending in over 30 states, vaccine bills, most of which, if passed, will require more vaccines of children than they're already getting now. We are the most highly vaccinated country in the world. We have in the U.S., we administer twice the number of vaccines of the average number of vaccines administered in 30 other Western nations. And ironically, we have a third world infant mortality rate. Ironic would maybe be a polite word for that. And there is at least one study I'm aware of that looked at the statistical correlation and found that as countries increase the number of vaccines, there's an increase in the infant mortality rate. Of course, causation isn't proof. Correlation is not proof of causation, but it certainly in this instance is a darn good reason to keep doing those studies that your other guests repeatedly point out are absent. I think that we live in a world where industry dictates policy and law, and the policy and law is not consistent with the scientific and medical realities. And some of the bills that are on the table, some of the laws that have already been passed, in my opinion, violate the Constitution. We have a law here in North Carolina that allows children of any age to consent to vaccines and other forms of medical treatment without the parents' knowledge and consent. To me, this is a blatant violation of constitutional parental rights. Parents have a right and an obligation, frankly, 14th Amendment due process right to parent their children. And unless you show that a parent is not fit to parent their child, they are presumed to be making decisions in the best interest of their child. And you can't even lawfully take that right away from all parents in the state collectively and give it to another adult absent an emergency or some other narrow category where that's appropriate, let alone give it to children who by definition are legally and medically or developmentally not capable of making those kinds of decisions. So it's a very disturbing trend. Some of the restrictions that have been passed in states and that are on the table in other states and current bills would require parents to jump through more hoops to get exemptions. And some of those restrictions, at least with regard to religious exemptions, in my opinion, violate, or with the ones that are pending bills, if passed, would violate the parents' First Amendment constitutional rights. The aggression is on multiple levels. In the just the last couple of years in particular, although it's been a trend that started as far as I have seen 3 or 4 years ago, but that really exploded fall a year ago and even more so just this past fall, is hospitals all over the country, usually by company policy, mandating flu shots for all hospital employees or they get fired. And in a few states, there are laws passed and attempts in other states to pass laws making this a requirement by law. This past fall, I worked with about 150 clients, healthcare worker clients in 26 states, and the overwhelming vast majority of the hospitals involved had put in religious exemption policies for their employees that violate federal civil rights law. They all seem to be reading from the same page somewhere, and at this point, I don't know what that page is or where it is. But I am not only counseling my clients about how to approach this so they have a legal exemption, a legal right, they understand what their rights are and what does and doesn't qualify for the exemption, for example, but I'm having to, through and with my clients, educate hospital administrators all over the country about federal civil rights law. Now, the vaccine mandates are a fairly new phenomenon, but the federal civil rights law and religion in the workplace has been around since 1964, the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964. So there really isn't an excuse that I can see for these people, hospital administrators all over the country, to be implementing policies that violate federal civil rights law. And as you point out, Obamacare provides grants for states that to promote vaccination in a number of ways, but that includes, as you say, going door to door. I'm very disturbed collectively of all these different things that are going on simultaneously at different levels that all taken together portray a very aggressive pro-vaccine policy that seems to be in very large part doing things the way they want to, whether it's medically justified or legally correct or not.
About 20 years ago, Alan, there was a movement in at least 40 states to have a licensure bill for dietitians, that the only people allowed to practice any form of nutritional counseling for free or fee were licensed dietitians. So you could have a PhD in nutrition from Harvard, but if you weren't a registered dietitian, you couldn't practice nutrition. And I was jumping from state to state to debate this issue and showing why, as a registered dietitian and as a PhD in human nutrition and public health science and as a professor at a university in nutritional sciences and a research fellow, why the least qualified people to talk about nutrition were dietitians. And yet, no matter which case we went on, we would win some, we won about half, but in time, they came back again. And again and again. And so I once asked a legislator in New Jersey, how is it possible that all these states are talking from the same playbook? Someone has to be behind the scenes. And the person said, there are people behind the scenes. Believe that. But we never found out who. Today, we know who is behind everything at the state level. It is a group of people that have worked in secret. Remarkable that they were only exposed a little over a year and a half ago in nearly 35 years. ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, representing more than 300 multinational corporations like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Walmart, etc. And they are brilliant at what they do. They have met on a regular basis in exclusive retreat areas like a big resort in Arizona, for example, this year. And they will meet with state legislators and they will give legislators bills. And these bills then are gone over and they're coached and told what to answer, how to go make it through. And more often than not, they're given co-sponsors. A person's not introducing something themselves. And generally they'll have Democrats and Republicans both. So it looks like it's a bipartisan bill. They then take these bills back to the states, and then they introduce them, and they become law. In fact, they've passed, we estimate, over 20,000 laws, and 800 were presented last year alone, bills. Now, why would a state legislator knowingly allow a major corporation to write an entire bill that only serves their interests and not the public, to keep this secret and to go ahead and do the bidding? And that is for any person to speculate. I don't have absolute information from every single person. I believe that every single legislator that is met at any time with any ALEC representative should be taken from office, forced to resign, because clearly they are not serving the public interest. But we just found out about this. So now I know who was behind the dietitian's bill. And when we were in New York, and Alan, you were in New York, in Albany, when we hastily put together an emergency protest in the state capitol to meet with the three top doctors in the state and to meet with the legislators and say, don't pass this emergency bill where all medical personnel in New York State, nurses, orderlies, physicians, must have these four vaccines, two, the H1N1, two of the flu. And then I gave 110 pages of scientific notes of why there was no efficacy that they could show, and there was a great deal of danger giving 24 micrograms of mercury in four doses or 100 milligrams of mercury, and I brought all the evidence, and I gave it to these men. And I said, then show me where there's a need. Show me where there's an epidemic. Show me where these healthcare professionals are putting patients at risk, and show me where you're not putting the healthcare worker at risk. And it was an extremely heated discussion that I had with Dr. Michael Schachter, an attorney, and the three top docs for the state in the Capitol when I was invited, when they saw that Fox News and others were there, and you were there, and Dr. Eisenstein from Chicago was there, and about 1,000 nurses were there, and they backed off, and we won the day. But who was behind that? I will bet anything it was Alex's major pharmaceutical company. They put the word out because you cannot have that kind of same exact laws time after time after time unless there is a group behind it. And ALEC is the number one group behind almost all these laws at the state level. Your thoughts on that?
Boy, there are many different points there. During the so-called swine flu pandemic of 2009 and 2010, there were 11 U.S. states that declared emergency. Virginia declared an emergency before they had documented a single case of swine flu. And the other states declared emergencies when they had a handful of cases documented. What kind of agenda must there be? I mean, I think sometimes we make the point, or a huge part of the point, just by asking the question, what's really going on here? A Dr. Wolfgang Vodarg, who was the chair of the medical committee, subcommittee on health of the Parliamentary Assembly, the Council of Europe, went public here in the U.S. in 2010 and said the swine flu pandemic was a fake. He pointed out that over the objections of several countries, the World Health Organization changed the level of definition of pandemic level 6, the highest level they can assign to a pandemic, so that a mild disease would qualify. When they did that, it triggered contract clauses with the pharmaceutical industry and countries around the world for the sale of $18 billion worth of swine flu vaccines, most of which were never administered. Here in the U.S., we threw out some $260 million of expired swine flu vaccines, and we had one of the higher percentage vaccination rates of the world. Other countries had proportionally much larger losses. They bought vaccines that ultimately didn't get administered. So there's serious, serious problems here. At the state legislative level and federal level as well, legislatures can pass laws whether they are constitutional or not. They can literally pass any law that they get the votes for. When in 2011, Washington State passed, and just before they passed, a modification of their vaccine exemption law that made it harder to get the exemption in Washington State. Through an activist there, I presented a legal argument to the governor's office pointing out that the bill that had just been voted on by both chambers was unconstitutional. The response we got back from the governor's office was, well, that's not really our concern. That's up for the courts to decide. Technically speaking, that's correct. A law is not formally or officially unconstitutional until a court says it is. So, but now every state legislature in the country takes an oath to uphold the state and federal constitution. When I sat down face to face with my own now former state representative here in North Carolina and said, look, this law that allows children to consent to vaccines, violates four state and federal constitutional provisions and four state and federal statutory provisions. It's a very bad law, and it was enacted for a purpose that was already covered by other state laws. So it was completely redundant and unnecessary. And my state senator looked me square in the eye, and she did not disagree with anything that I had said about these statutory and constitutional conflicts at both the state and federal level. And she says, I can't help you. We have UNC hospitals in our district. So the message here is that our policy and law is not driven by science when it concerns scientific issues, or not clearly not always. It may, you know, this may not be an absolute condition, but clearly that's an optional consideration for legislators where they're dealing with issues that maybe raise a possible legal problem. Is this bill we're about to pass, is this going to be a constitutional law or not? There is obviously not a proper screening process in most, if not all, state legislatures to weed out proposed laws that don't meet constitutional or other legal standards. But the bottom line is, they don't have to. If they get the votes, they can pass it anyway. And then it's up to us as the citizens to find the way to challenge that in court if we want to do something about it, or get our representatives to modify or repeal the law. That these are not usually straightforward, easy processes. And so if you get the votes and you get the bill you want passed, it's likely to hang around for a while, maybe a long time, if it favors the position of those who can afford to pay lobbyists, such as pharmaceutical industry. So it's a very, very difficult situation here. There's corruption that is systemic. There aren't any short, quick, easy answers here that I see.
I appreciate those insights, Alan. Tony, let's say right now that one of the more popular vaccine mandating programs is for Gardasil. You've examined Gardasil in depth. I just filmed last week, one of the primary scientists who worked on the actual Gardasil vaccine, Diane Harper. Could you tell us why the public and the media are so disconnected from the truth of what happens when we rush through in different states, or try to rush through in different states, including Texas, New Jersey, and others, to make sure that we're protecting the children, when indeed that is not the motivation, and it's certainly not the outcome? Tell us what we should know about Gardasil as an example of vaccine mandate gone wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I do that, I just want to point out that as a physician, when you take care of immune-suppressed patients, people who've just had transplants, anybody on specific meds, you have to tell your patient to avoid children that have just been vaccinated with live viruses because they shed the virus and can spread disease. I just want to bring that up because it hasn't been brought up, and I think it's a very important piece of this argument. But I will answer your question regarding the Gardasil vaccine. You know, the Gardasil vaccine was created, and as you know, Dr. Harper probably explained this better, but for very high-risk populations, mostly in Africa, mostly in third world countries, where there are not pap smear screenings for cervical cancer and dysplasia. And the coverage, the antibody coverage, is short-lived, which is contrary to what the public thinks. And, you know, if you're exposed to HPV and then get your vaccine, your risk of dysplasia, precancerous lesions, actually goes up at least by 50%, which was found in a post-surveillance study in Norway. And so the realities of this vaccine is that it is not that great in terms of effectiveness, in terms of long-term. It's very short-term in terms of its effectiveness and antibody response, or at least efficacy, because we don't know anything about the effectiveness, because cervical cancer takes 15 years on average to grow. And the study was fast-tracked as an emergency. It got fast-track approval. I'm also a disaster manager, and I can tell you that we have fast-track approval for outbreaks, which we haven't really had. But we're fast-tracking vaccines as though we're having these deadly outbreaks right and left. And because of that, they studied the vaccine for, I think, just a little under 2 years. And so we don't know if it actually prevents cancer.
at all. But theoretically, it does impart some antibody response in some people for about 3 to 5 years. But if you then, once it wanes, get exposed, we know that if you received a booster, you will increase your risk of cervical dysplasia. So there's a lot of problems with this vaccine, and I haven't even gotten into the VAERS claims. The VAERS reports, which is a vaccine adverse events reporting system, has had more reports to this system just for this vaccine than all vaccines combined. Mostly, we think, because of the aluminum adjuvant, which is so neurotoxic. It's a newer aluminum adjuvant, which also the vaccine contains 2080 or polysorbate, which breaches the blood-brain barrier. So there's many problems with this vaccine in terms of its safety and its risk and taking it and the coverage itself. But what we see is that at the state level, Merck, at least for Gardasil, paid state legislators $15,000. Sorry, that was for the chickenpox, but they paid them to come, and they also brought them and hosted many events where they presented material that looked like it was educational material for the state legislators and for physicians. So physicians were going to events that looked like educational events with educational material, and in fact, it was marketing propaganda. I mean, and that's right out of Diane's words, I believe, that it was marketing propaganda. And so there was a lot of misleading information. If you ask a typical physician that gives Gardasil, they'll tell you it's lifelong immunity. It's not true. They were never told that, but the implications were such as that. And so there's a big disconnect, and they did a great job. Merck did an amazing job on their advertising campaign, the One Less Girl, which, of course, those of us on this side of it and have seen the deaths say, yeah, they were talking about one less girl, but their implication was one less cervical cancer death. But I also feel like Merck and Glaxo, which makes the Cervarix, they're trying to rewrite history, talking about this cervical cancer being the second leading most cause of cancer death in the country. Well, it's not the second leading most cancer death in women in this country or in any other first world country or second world country that does pap smears. It is in Africa, in areas where there's no pap smears, but in this country it is, I believe, the 19th leading cause of cancer death in women and has been since we've instated pap smears. And so there's just a big disconnect in the realities around this vaccine. And now, of course, many states are voting it in where children can be approached and at the school level by their optometrist, by pharmacists, and can obtain the vaccine after being pressured without parental permission. And
Tony, we have to go on to one last question for Mary.
Sure.
Holland, but I appreciate that input. Mary, I'd like to look at the Nuremberg Code for a second because it establishes an international rule for medical ethics. All of these attempts to subvert the population to a vaccine agenda seem to be in direct violation of the code. The code's essential principle was to assure that never again would the medical claims of a society trump that of the individual. And the first precipice states that, quote, voluntary informed consent to medical research is absolutely essential, end quote. Now, since no vaccine is absolutely effective and safe, is it fair to say within a legal definition that vaccines are still an experimental science? We know that vaccine companies are always trying to improve vaccine efficacy and safety. There are many new types of vaccine technologies, such as the new DNA techniques that would replace vaccines relying upon animal tissue media for viral culturing, that companies believe would be an improvement on current vaccines. Therefore, in principle, vaccination remains an experimental science. No magic vaccine bullet has ever been discovered. So if this is so, then vaccination still is an experimental phase, and vaccine mandates would therefore be in direct conflict, at least from my understanding, of the Nuremberg Code. Could you elucidate, please?
Yes. So the Nuremberg Code was critical. The world said that the experiments that the Nazi doctors did on victims were absolutely unacceptable. But what the Nuremberg Code was limited to research. And one of the things that the global community has realized over since World War II is that we needed to extend it. And so very importantly, in 2005, the United Nations body, UNESCO, signed a declaration meant to be universal. The United States participated in it, which covers both research and treatment, with the idea that you have to have informed consent for both. And so what the U.S. has explicitly accepted at an international level is that all medical interventions, quote, you know, in parentheses, including vaccination, require prior, free, and informed consent. What we're doing with vaccination is not informed consent. Informed consent is the hallmark of ethical modern medicine. This is really it's extremely coercive, and it's now really pushing towards universally compulsive. So it certainly violates the Nuremberg principles, and it specifically violates the 2005 Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights. There's just no question about that.
I appreciate it. My final thought is this. Recently, the nation's leading guru for vaccination, Dr. Poe Offit at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, wrote an opinion piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer, putting out the case that religious exemption should be dropped as a parental choice for their children. And of course, he denies philosophical exemption is legitimate as well. What I found most disturbing about this article, and perhaps reflecting on his bias, is that he equates the child abuse scandals at Penn State, which led to stronger laws, with parents who exempt their children from vaccination. And it's a very disgusting article, in my opinion. So I wish that people knew how much effort is being placed upon our representatives at the state and the federal level to mandate vaccines, but also to mandate out of existence people's freedom of choice. And every article I have read shows that those parents who are limiting or removing their children or themselves from vaccines are the most educated. So it says a lot when we don't want people who've educated themselves on an issue to have the same freedom to exercise what their constitutional liberties should provide. I want to thank my panel, Alan Phillips, VaccineRights.com, Professor Mary Holland, VaccineEpidemic.com, Dr. Tony Bark, Disease-Reversal.com, and Robert Krakow, KrakowLawFirm.com, for joining us and sharing your very enlightened positions. Thank you all.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall.
Thank you all for listening.